difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a new release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with...
Tosh Robinson.
Keith Phipps.
Rachel Handler.
And producer Genevieve Kosky. This week, we're talking about Mike Nichols' celebrated screen adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Andrew Hayes' new film, 45 Years, which deals with another long-term marriage in turmoil. Since many of you probably haven't seen 45 Years yet... we'll try to go lighter on the spoilers than usual, but it's not always easy to talk around them, so proceed with mild caution, I would say. The tone of 45 Years is nothing like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Kate and Jeff Mercer, played by Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay, rarely raise their voices and never seek to do deliberate harm to one another. By appearances, they live a quiet and settled life in the English countryside, and the people attending their 45th anniversary are likely to see them as a nice older couple going gently into that good night. But the emotions in 45 Years are, in their own way, every bit as turbulent. When Jeff gets word that the body of his former lover has been found in the ice in Switzerland, where she went missing over 50 years earlier, it sets off a series of revelations about their relationship that shakes the Mercers' marriage to the core.
That's something I want to tell you.
Okay.
I feel sure I've told you before, but it was a long time ago, so I could be wrong.
Okay, go on.
Yeah. I was her next of kin.
What do you mean?
Well, officially, I was her next of kin. I'm sure I told you this before.
Well, I think I remember her husband being another woman's next of kin.
So before we get into our form, I just wanted to go around the room again and see what you thought of this film that I love very much and hope you feel the same way. Tosh Robinson, what did you think of the film 45 Years?
I think you're leading the witness is what
okay.
I think. You
will disappoint me if you did not love this movie.
Prepare for your disappointment, Scott. I love disappointing you as much as I love disagreeing with you. I was not as sold on this film as you were. I mean, I think it's a fine film. I think it's engaging. And I think the performances are superlative. But compared to the fireworks of Virginia Woolf, it certainly didn't move me emotionally or hook me in as much. It wasn't as heartbreaking as the end of Virginia Woolf. It wasn't as terrifying as all of the other parts of Virginia Woolf. I didn't have the emotional connection to it that you did. And so I'm very curious to see where that comes from.
Goodness. What about you, Keith?
I did. I was very moved by it. I'd say, I'm not going to say better or worse, but it is a more emotionally moving film than Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I mean, I felt like I knew these characters in a way that I didn't necessarily know the characters in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I think they were, Abby draws them as very kind of big types in a way, whereas these felt like people you might meet walking down a certain streets in certain parts of England and perhaps never get to know, as Scott said, unless if it weren't for something like this.
For sure. What about you, Rachel? What do you think?
I really, really liked it a lot. I don't know if I would put one over the other. I think I had really different responses. This one was much sadder, I think. It was much more... I think it was a little more actually emotional, while the other one was a little scarier. The only thing I wished is that I wished it had explored what had happened to Katya a little bit more. That I felt left wanting in that way. By the end, I think there were loose threads in that area. But in terms of an exploration of a marriage, I thought it was really, really effective and moving.
I'm curious to follow up on that. What do you mean? What do we need to know about her?
I guess I don't know that this was really the point, but I was a little disappointed that he didn't go to Switzerland. I kind of just wanted to see her in the ice.
You want to see in the ice?
Hanging in the ice.
That's like Tasha with the weird ending that she imagined for All the President's Men. I don't want to see any of that.
I was like, wait, damn it. We're not even going to get to see her in the ice. I think that's because I just really like dark movies, and I was like, this should be a little bit darker.
Yeah.
I'm picturing some horrible fakey thing out of the Ice Age movies where there's just this glacier and Scrat is stuck in action pose right. In the middle of it with his eyeballs
right.
Moving around.
I was picturing it more like the end of The Shining where he's just frozen. Kind of like that. That's what I wanted from this movie.
to me, though, I think that what I was thinking about this movie is it's kind of fine by the movies that it isn't. Like, it could be about Jeff, hearing the news of his lover being frozen in the ice, which is such a strange thing, but also such a great metaphor as it plays out in the film for how the past doesn't really go away. You know, how we're distanced from it, and yet it's always there at the same time. But it could be about him, you know, reconnecting with his past and you know, remembering the man he used to be and the love that he lost. But it's not about that. It's not his movie. It could be about her. His wife, Kate, kind of learning to accept that and kind of coming to this revelation. And there's moments, particularly at the end, I'm dancing around this, but that they're set up as almost like these moments of relief or these moments where you know, forgiveness and like kind of acceptance. And it's not that movie either. And to me, that's what makes this movie so interesting is there's conventional routes it could go down. And it simply does not.
Oh, it's got the best ending outside of Phoenix in movies this year.
No ice corpse, though. I just want the ice corpse.
Yes. If they had added an ice corpse, then it really would have taken
off. Then it would have been 100% for me.
I mean, 2015 was quite the year for films that end like just with the camera looking at a woman having an internal mental moment, you know, because that like that's how Carol ended mm-hmm. too. That's right. It's how Anomalisa ends. Like it feels like I saw variations on that shot, Entourage. And they're all very different.
No. So why not Katya?
Why not Katya?
I ask you.
One thing I will say though that I really liked about the film. Again, and this is just something that we are privileged to see in a way, is the idea that marriage is not settled, that you know, as long as a couple has stayed together, and this couple has been together for a long time, that there's a dynamic there that I think defies the idea that people, you know, whatever, grow old and, you know, settle down together. I mean, I think this is a film that says that's not really the case, that it's still, you know, a pretty lively affair, even though in this case it turns into a very sad affair. You know, I've seen this film twice, and you know what was interesting to me, I had two different experiences, because I think that the film is told really is really about her, is really, you know, she is the focus of the film. We learn about revelations from his past and the way they affect her as she starts to explore it. It goes too far, really, to explore it and learning things she doesn't want to learn, and it's devastating to that extent too. But watching a second time, I was a little more mindful of him and what he must be going through as well, and it's equally heartbreaking from that point of view too, because fundamentally he lost the love of his life. I mean, you know, in the life that he has taken on with Kate is substantial, and he loves her for sure, but it's not necessarily the life that he imagined for himself, and that's a painful truth for him as well as for Kate.
You know, you put a lot of sympathy to Kate. I mean, it's hard not to have incredible sympathy for to find, you know, sort of dealing with the idea that she's this man she spent her life with. You know, she's his second choice, but also it's hard not to feel for him too. She's not really giving him any space or allowing him any sort of room to process what this discovery and what it means to him. Because since she's not really comfortable allowing anything into their marriage that's not related to her in some ways.
I mean, you say that the movie could have been more about Jeff processing and wasn't. That was what I wanted more of. Like one of the reasons I think I felt distanced from this movie is because I feel very distanced from her. I think the movie has more sympathy for her than I do. I mean, one of the things that I saw in this movie, it's certainly not the only thing, but a strong kind of thread through it is just about her jealousy of a woman who died 50 years ago and who is not a central part of her husband's life. And yet she can't seem to bear that he has these memories of someone else. She can't seem to bear that he had this experience outside of her. And it doesn't seem fair to him at all.
Okay. But no, see, I would dispute that on this front. It's not just about his feelings about this woman who has been dead for 50 years. It is about what he wanted from his life and what his marriage to her has yielded, you know, and it has yielded, in this case, a dog. I think that is the painful thing. You know, this was, you know, his second choice, really, for this is not the option that he necessarily wanted or he imagined for himself when he was with this other woman. And I think, you know, even after so much time together, almost especially after so much time together, I think that's a really, really painful thing to deal with. And I think there becomes a point in 45 years where she goes, and she admits as much, goes too far. I mean, she starts questioning him And I think it's they're in bed, and she just says, "Okay, I can't talk about this anymore."
I mean, I think that's one of the most devastating things that happens in the film is her choosing to shut him out. You know, she's the one who is doggedly going after this issue, and then she's the one who like raises it all up and then cuts it all off. And her amount of control over the conversation. It openly bothered me. I mean, we talk a lot about, especially in comic books, the problem with fridging women, the problem with women in stories who die in order to give men some kind of catharsis or some kind of emotional upset or some kind of man pain drama. I feel like the opposite happens in this film. Something horrible, like a man loses a woman that he loved, and we keep backburnering what he's doing with it and how he's feeling about it so we can focus on how his wife feels about this thing she wasn't a part of.
But I think that's a different movie, though.
Yeah. Movie. But what I'm saying is I don't know if I might have engaged in that movie more. That's the alternate universe. You know, that's Earth 2 and we're not there. Mm. But there were times when I was like, you know, couldn't you restrain your jealousy just a little in order to feel what he's feeling or listen to him when he talks about what he's feeling. Because I feel like he tells her over and over what's going on in his head and she doesn't want to believe it.
I don't know that he does tell her. I think he's just as sort of elusive about his feelings as she is. But I agree with you that this is what I'm saying when I'm talking about the Ice Corps. I think there's another movie there. There's another path that it could have gone down that I would have liked to see also. If there was a way to sort of to marry the two, so to speak.
I want to read this room correctly. We have two female contributors here who want the focus to be more on the men.
Yep.
No, I want the dead woman.
I
was literally fridged.
I'm very aware of this. Oh my God, she really was. I'm very aware of the contradiction here. Yeah. This is, and I think it's interesting because this is not something I usually say.
No, I agree.
Won't someone please think of the men? What are the men thinking in this movie?
And I say, no, only women.
I was very happy to see have Charlotte Rampling as the focal point of this film because I think what she does here is extraordinary. And I think I think she's an amazing actress, and this is a career highlight for sure. Because I find she's able to convey so much, often without even saying anything, that to me was focus enough and story enough for the film. I wanted to see her, and I wasn't always necessarily sympathetic to her actions, but I was very sympathetic to her position and what she must be feeling. And to me, I thought that was enough drama to carry the whole film.
And I just really respect the film for having a point of view and for sticking with it and for showing this whole thing play out from one angle and not the other, because I think more of an equal time thing. That just feels like television to me. It seems like just
what a contempt.
Such contempt for television.
Television.
just show that, you know. I think, you know, and again, on second viewing, I think you can start, for me anyway, I started to think a little bit more about Jeff and what he was going through, and you know, maybe sort of validating some of his sadness in trouble. But yeah, just I think it is devastating and proper to really throw the focus on her, and it's a complex character. She's dealing with a complex situation, and I think the film gets you to this remarkable point at the end, and again, I'm going to try to be as vague as possible, where you think it's going to go one way, and it doesn't go that way, and I think the ending is, the film is so true and bold and beautiful. It's got a great final shot. I just really had a lot of respect for it.
You're really choking up, aren't you?
No, I'm just nervous. So let's get into the topics a little bit. Tasha, what have you got for us?
I just wanted to bring up the concept of old marrieds. You know, people, it's a phrase that we use. You know, you two are fighting like old marrieds. It's a phrase that's been used about me and Scott. and how it kind of plays into both of these relationships, really kind of all three of the relationships we see on screen. In both 45 Years and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, we see these people that have been together so long that they know where like all of the buttons are for each other. When they're fighting, they know exactly where the sore spots are. But you also see that they have just kind of a comfortable language with each other. They have comfortable routines, which in George and Martha's case are really ugly routines. In Kate and Jeff's case are such comfortable routines that she gets really upset when they're upset, like by him deciding to go for a walk. He actually leaves her a note that says he's sorry because he went for a walk, which, you know, she wasn't expecting him to go for a walk without her. There's so much about familiarity in both these movies and how upsetting it is to people in long marriages when it comes undone, even in the slightest way, and how the introduction of an outside element can just really disrupt what's become a comfortable routine, even if it's a very uncomfortable, comfortable routine.
Yeah, and I think one way it plays out really well in 45 years is the way smoking plays into it.
Where
he starts smoking on the sly, and I forget which one. Yeah, she says, "I don't want us to start smoking again." And it's definitely sort of a you do it, I do it, and we see her smoking later. And it's like it's kind of there's an understanding that what one person does inevitably is going to, you know, what one person's routine is inevitably going to become the other person's routine. It's almost. Well, like a dead ringers kind of thing in a way. Marriage eventually, I guess, turned you into creepy identical twins in its own way.
Yeah, it's been an odd day.
Sure has.
I just stayed at home, you know, grappling with the bald cock. But you're right. I hardly go walking anymore. It was a nice day, so off I went.
So where did you go?
Just to the village.
To buy cigarettes? I haven't lost my sense of smell, you know.
Man.
I just don't want us to start smoking again.
I won't. Promise.
Well, and also, it also really ends up highlighting those moments where the routine is broken and where they do things they haven't done in a long time, like dancing and effing.
We're trying to avoid the explicit tag here, guys. We are all capable of saying the F word in real life.
Oh, you bet. You bet.
Bouncy.
Yeah. What is the 70s game show way of saying it?
Making whoopee.
Yeah. So in any case, these are things that they don't do all the time, and I think they're really unsettled about the situation and needing to affirm the relationship, and the way you do that sometimes is you know, F it out
or smoke it out.
I was gonna say dance it out, you know, cuddle, have a good cuddle. Tasha, your topic actually leads a little bit into mine. Can I go?
Can I first just say, like, I was actually glad when we saw her smoking, because it meant when she said, "I don't want us to start smoking again," it wasn't some kind of like royal we, like when men say we're pregnant, which has always unsettled me a little bit. If she had meant, "I don't want us to start smoking again," meaning "I don't want you to start smoking again," that would have just been some ugly stuff about the relationship. But Scott, I believe that you had a topic.
I have a somewhat related topic that I wanted to get into, which is truth or illusion. The big line, as we talked in the first segment about, you know, truth or illusion, George, you don't know the difference. No, but we must carry on as though we did. That's a key exchange in Virginia Woolf, but I think it applies equally to the marriage in 45 years, which proceeds from the falsehood that Jeff's relationship to his former lover isn't as significant to him as it clearly is. You know, Kate makes the observation that his feelings for her have always lingered in their marriage, his feelings for Katya. But part of their tacit marital contract is that neither one of them will bring it up. This may sound unhealthy, but it has sustained this marriage for 45 years. This illusion that Jeff's life with Kate, with a dog and without a child, is the one he willingly and happily entered into. And the truth, once it surfaces in full, becomes too painful to bear.
And part of that is just, it's because of that old married couple disruption, because there's something in there that obviously we don't want to give away, but if you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about. There's something that's in the whole past she didn't know about, that he hasn't brought up with her. And it doesn't necessarily seem like the world's biggest secret when you know what it is, because you can see why he chose not to talk about it. But the fact that he chose not to talk about it makes her far more vulnerable in a situation where she's already feeling vulnerable, because it's something that wasn't part of their dynamic. And now it is, and she doesn't know how to talk about it.
Well, the other thing, too, that now I'm just thinking about it, connecting it to Virginia Woolf, is that it's actually maybe more analogous to Nick and Honey and her pregnancy, hysterical pregnancy or whatever, that brought them into this marital bond to begin with.
And puff.
Yeah, and I think
the puff went poof.
Is that a real thing, a hysterical pregnancy?
A hysterical pregnancy is a real thing, but there's a reveal in that movie that's particularly deadly about exactly what the nature of her pregnancy was.
But you can see that. That's this detonation that's kind of waiting to go off in both cases, right? Mm-hmm. That this exists, this happened, and this happened really early on. And in 45 years, it's happened before the Jeff's relationship with Kate even started, but it's there. And if you light that powder keg, you know, it's going to explode, and it's just waiting there to explode and destroy this marriage. So I think in all of these cases, there is a need really to maintain an illusion, to not bring up something very true and fundamental about the relationship. There's a fundamental problem with the relationship that if they actually were to talk about it explicitly, could be the undoing of the marriage.
Yeah, I think both films make that same point, that there needs to be certain lies that you tell each other every single day for something to function. I mean, there's even a line in 45 Years where she says, I'd like to be able to tell you everything I'm thinking and everything I know, but I can't. Do you understand? Or something like that. And he says, yeah, I do. So I think they both realize the same thing almost in completely different ways. And Virginia Woolf, they realize it by living in this insane way for so long and then bashing it in at the end. And then in 45 Years, they think that they've got it all figured out the whole time, and then they realize that they don't. So I think that was really interesting to me. It's just sort of the two ways you can come to that realization, but it's the same realization.
That line really stood out to me because it feels like to me in that moment when she says, you know, I have all these things in my head and I can't tell you. You know what I mean? And he says, yeah. I feel like she's using that as a weapon. She's withholding on purpose. And he understands. She's withholding in a way in order to hurt the relationship.
You really don't like Kate.
No, I really don't. And it kind of comes down to this moment. So I'm really curious how the three of you interpreted that. Because to me, it feels like in that moment, she's withholding in order to hurt him. Whereas what he's saying is, I've been withholding this whole time in order to help us, in order to make this relationship possible. I feel like they're doing the same thing for different reasons. And it makes me dislike her.
I took it as her admitting that she was upset about it. But she knew that saying that out loud to him would be sort of an irreparable conversation. I think that they were both protecting each other in that.
If you do go, and if I...
Oh, Christ, Kate, this isn't about Katya.
Please stop saying her name.
It
I can't hear it.
It isn't it, about Katya.
It is. Of course it is. Like me discovering what the smell is around the house.
Oh, please.
And it's her perfume. Okay? It's like she's been standing in the corner of the room all this time behind my back.
Oh, come on.
And it's tainted everything. All our decisions, where we go on holiday, what books we read, what dog you want to choose, what music we want to listen to. And the big things, too. Especially the big things.
She's had nothing to do with any of that.
I'd like to be able to tell you everything I'm thinking and everything I know, but I can't. Do you understand that?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Keith, what's your topic?
I want to talk about the past, which sort of kind of dovetails to what we were just talking about, but I want to talk about it in a couple of different ways. And one is how each of these films fills in the past. I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It kind of all comes spilling out over the course of a few hours after 2 a.m. And 45 Years, you get a week, and it kind of comes out a lot slower. Little bits of dialogue where we learn about their past, all these things about how they don't have any photographs on the wall and what they would have photographs for. And it's sort of a really nice way to convey what's important to these characters. The other thing I want to talk about is sort of the past that these actors bring to the role in both films. Like with Burton and Taylor had a very, very, very public off-screen relationship, two marriages, public tumult and other broken relationships that kind of led into it. And it's kind of hard, maybe it's easier for us from a distance of 50 years to separate that as we watch it. Tom Courtenay and Charlotte Rampling have a whole history on screen that they bring to it too. Courtenay being a very, you know, a staple of early 60s films like Billy Liar and The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. He's worked in films since then. He's probably a lot more in theater, but definitely less so in America, but in the UK, a very well-known figure. And Rampling kind of came to public prominence in more in the late 60s, early 70s, but there's a whole history of characters that she brought to the screen as well, including a lot of edgy characters. So kind of seeing her playing a settled down older woman is a little bit of playing against the Charlotte Rampling characters of the past. So
even of the recent past.
Oh, the recent past, swimming pool.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, mostly when I think of Charlotte Rampling, I think of these very nuanced and very contained characters, and that falls into what she's doing here. I don't have nearly as much familiar with Courtenay. I think with Burton and Taylor, there's too much of that. It's interesting to me how time can make most cases of people in real life relationships being on screen together, like, become irrelevant. Like, we don't necessarily care as much that Ben Affleck was dating J-Lo, like, during the time of Geely.
We watch Geely now, that's not what we're thinking about.
No, except for the part where we don't watch Geely right now. But I see what I mean. I think I did actually just say that. But yeah, that is what I mean. It plays differently, like, many years later. But Burton and Taylor were such a thing for so long and so famously that it's hard even now to escape that connection.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to address one thing that you said also about Rampling and Courtenay in this film is that you know, these are vital performances, you know, in characters who are themselves, again, dynamic. You know, I think with old couples, we just think they're just settling into old people roles. Mm-hmm. And this is not, I don't think this is, you know, I mean, we're aware of their age, both ages, particularly Courtenay, who's a little more frail in this, but it's not settled. These are both very lively, engaged, vital performances.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're younger, you kind of see old age as sort of a, you know, a long coda, like, you know, all your business is taken care of, you can just kind of glide into the sunset. But I don't think that's necessarily, as I get older myself, I mm-hmm. see that not being the case. And as I watch the lives of my parents' generation, that, you know, it's not, you know, life continues, drama continues. It's interesting to see that portrayed in this film.
And part of that is your cultural impact continues. And as we're seeing the baby boomers age, we're seeing more and more of these films, mm-hmm. you know, Amour and Away From Her and the Marigold Hotel movies and on. We're seeing more films that take place in a world where people are allowed to be older but still have sex lives and still have unresolved issues and still have emotions and still have conflicts, because more and more people are culturally driving the conversation by being around and buying tickets and saying, you know, we do still have all of these things, and we are actually interested in movies that aren't about, you know, a bunch of young kids.
One other way the movie brings out the past in interesting ways is music. There's, of course, the recurring theme of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which you hear Rampling's character humming early and plays a major role throughout the film, but also just other ways. The soundtrack is very 60s. The soundtrack is very much songs from when, you know, these characters were younger, and I think that plays out very interestingly. And also, you know, you can't help but think of, again, of Rampling and Courtenay's own past as culture icons. It's kind of like to, maybe not as pronounced or as deliberate, but kind of like Peter Fonda and Terrence Stamp in The Limey, where you can't avoid what these characters meant, you know, 30, 40 years ago, what these actors meant 30 or 40 years ago, and see that reflected in the characters.
Yeah, and in 45 years, you get the lyrics of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes becoming very relevant. Mm. And in Virginia Woolf, you have the repeated refrain of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with them singing it, which is very interesting to me, mostly because it's calling back to a scene that we didn't see. It's calling back to a joke that Martha apparently made at a party that everybody loved, mm-hmm. including her husband. And just through the repeated, like, let's go back to that moment where I was hilarious and everyone loved me, we're not only going back to the Bergen story and, like, how the connection he still feels with that all these years later, we're going back to a moment at a party where apparently they don't do this in public, because they were enough of a successful couple at that party that this other couple was willing to come home with them. They were entertaining. They were lively. He laughed at her jokes. Apparently they have a public persona that we didn't really get to see. And just through evoking the fact that that joke went over so well over and over, they're reminding us that this is how they are in private. This isn't necessarily how they are in public.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and the same thing at the end of 45 years when he's singing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes to her, and it's so uncomfortable. At least I felt really uncomfortable. It seemed so strained and awkward and forced, and it just kept going. That was really effective for me as an ending, just that particular portion where he's pretending just to be joking around and singing the lyrics, but they're so almost because they're too resonant.
For sure. So, Rachel, you had some thoughts on the settings of both of these films.
I thought it was really fascinating that both of these films use the idea of the house as a visual metaphor. They both really fixate on shots of the house. They open on shots of the house. It's this constant presence, this claustrophobic trap for both of them. And in both films, I think stands as in contrast to the chaos of nature and the rest of the world in general, which is a recurring theme in both too. And so it represents both their safe haven and their prison at the same time. In 45 years, there are only a few scenes that happen outside of the house, and they're never really outside of it together until the end, which I thought was really interesting. And whenever they leave it, they're either hiding from each other or spying on each other. And I love how Andrew Hay uses the different rooms in the house to represent different sort of physical and emotional states. The attic is obviously representative of Jeff's past and his sort of his own mind where he goes to escape. And she's trying so hard to get in there, and at the end, near the end, she does. But and then similarly, he uses the house to frame their conversations. There's one conversation they're having, I think the one where she's making fun of him for reading Kierkegaard, and you can't even see him. He's obscured the entire time by a bookcase. And similarly, there's all this visual attention paid to nature. In the beginning, we have this beautiful shot of the house and all this lush green grass, and then midway through, she's staring out her window, looking at this bush of full of dead leaves. And there seems to me, at least, this recurring theme that nature sort of encroaching on them, the chaos of it, the wildness of it, the unpredictability of it, represented with Katya's fridging. and Jeff becomes obsessed with global warming, with the way the earth is changing. And he starts going for walks more, and he's outside. And it's, to me, it was sort of this dichotomy of indoors and outdoors in both films. Like, you can't predict what's going to happen outside of the house, but inside the house you're safe, quote unquote, but at what cost?
That's really a neat thought. Although I feel like in Virginia Woolf, outside is representing, well, okay, I guess it depends. When George and Nick go off together and are talking around the swing, it seems like outside represents a refuge. Mm-hmm. It's a rescue. It's like they're not around their spouses anymore, and they can almost connect in a way that's immediately undone when they go back inside. But then I guess later when Martha's wandering around outside, and you get the incredible overhead shot.
Yeah.
It represents something very different, being outside.
Sinister, yeah.
And being alone,
right,
and isolated.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
Then I wonder if it was a mistake, actually, in Virginia Woolf to open it up to the extent where they go to that, you know, bar or whatever and continue
the roadhouse.
The roadhouse. I mean, does it, you maybe some lose what you gain, I guess, in a new space, you might lose in some of the intensity of really being confined in a way that you are when you see the play, you know, which can, again, be played in a modest-sized room such as the one we are sitting in. So 45 Years is making its way around the country, boosted by strong reviews and the certainty of a Charlotte Rampling Oscar nomination. She should win. I mean, the actress category is incredible, but Charlotte Rampling, holy smokes. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is available on DVD in the States, but not Blu-ray. You'd have to go overseas. You'd have to import. But it is available for streaming rental from most of the usual sources. I watched it on Google Play. So we will be right back with our recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Rachel, you want to kick us off? What in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, Scott, I have a film-related item known as a book.
Oh.
I finally saw Carol this week. It took me a while because I was waiting to see it with someone. And I read the book the day after. The book gets based on The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith. And I really liked the experience of watching it and then reading the book, because I think it really demonstrates how well Todd Haynes and Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara translated the material, but also really improved upon it. I think the book provides a really in-depth look at the interior life of Therese, but you get almost all of it from the movie, which is really, really interesting, because I didn't feel like there was a ton of new information in the book, even though it was literally her internal narrative. They were able to convey so much in Carol with just glances and short bits of dialogue that was conveyed in an entire novel, which was obviously great on its own terms too, but it really, really amplified Carol as a work of art for me.
And there's like a structural addition to the film too that mm-hmm. I think, I mean, from what I understand, that just makes the film work
yeah
great
yeah
Yeah, but it's still, you know, we're not dissing Patricia Highsmith.
No, I would read the book. If you like the movie, you'll like the book.
That's not always true with me with Patricia Highsmith. Like, I really wanted to read all of the Ripley's Game books after seeing the first Ripley movie and realizing how many times other people had translated the Ripley books into different movies, or the first two Ripley books. And I always found her prose just so blunt. Like, how did you find the prose in this?
It was a little bit, but again, I think I was reading it less for wondering about her prose and reading it more wondering about the movie and how they managed to take it over to the screen and what things they kept and what they didn't and how much of the internal life was represented. I wasn't really paying as much attention as I usually do to her prose, but yeah, it was a little Highsmithy.
So Keith, what about you?
Speaking of Patricia Highsmith,
there's
a new Blu-ray edition of The American Friend from Vendor's 1977 film, which is an adaptation of Ripley's Game, actually, the third Ripley book and a little bit of the second one, apparently. I've read them, but it's been a while, and I like her prose. But it's there's an interesting story behind it, which he wanted to adapt all these other Highsmith novels that are already spoken for, and he actually met with Highsmith and said, you know, you can definitely adapt this one because no one's even seen it yet. And he proceeded to basically not adapt it, or at least adapt it extremely loosely. It's a really interesting movie in which Bruno Ganz plays this framer / art restorer who kind of offends Tom Ripley, as played by Dennis Hopper, which is an interesting choice that pays off really well in the film, although not necessarily the Ripley you encounter in the books, and kind of gets drawn into this underworld of crime and kind of watches his soul get taken bit by bit as the deeper he gets into it, and it's the plot is possibly may not be possible to follow, and I'm not even sure that's really the point. The atmosphere is extremely eerie. I mean, Vendors is kind of a master of alienation and travel, and there's a lot of that in this film, and it's shot by his frequent collaborator Robbie Mueller, and in the ways that the new transfer really bring out is this kind of like this vivid, sickly colors. It's really quite good, and I'd recommend it.
I mean, I saw that film in college on VHS, and I remember it just being drab as VHS is. But I'm kind of excited to see it, to see the Criterion and see what it actually is supposed to look like.
Yeah, I'd seen the previous DVD version, which I thought looked quite good, but this is a kind of a revelation. They really did a good job with this one.
Tasha, what about you?
Two things. Just in brief, I finally caught up on Ryan Coogler's Creed, which when it came out, I had no particular intention of seeing yet another Rocky film / yet another boxing film. And Pop Culture Happy Hour, one of my all-time favorite podcasts, and a podcast featuring a bunch of friends of ours, just like big upped it. They did an entire episode about why Creed is great and why it will make you cry and what emotional response to film in general is like. So they persuaded me to see it, and I finally watched it last night. They did not steer me wrong. I really enjoyed that movie a lot.
Creed is good.
I haven't seen Creed yet.
So yeah, it's beautifully directed. It brings a lot of nuance to the sports underdog story, that like little nuances that I wasn't expecting. So I found it a lot more interesting than I was expecting, and way more emotional. I am not a film crier, as I often say, and I cried at this movie.
So I'll definitely cry.
It's been like a thing for people to talk about how they cry as a thing.
Yeah.
Guys especially, like, I cried at Creed.
For sure. Well, Pop Culture Happy Hour goes a bunch into that, which I found fascinating. It's the phenomenon of men kind of semi-bragging, semi-humble bragging, maybe, that they cried at Creed.
Thought I couldn't feel anything anymore when I saw Creed.
I thought my face and my life was as unexpressive as Sylvester Stallone, but then I saw Creed.
I have three words for them. Pull it together. Pull it together.
You didn't cry?
Pull it together, bros.
No, it's just that Scott is a super bro, and he does not like seeing other men express emotion. Yeah. But in brief, another thing that I was really excited about recently that was not recommended to me by Pop Culture Happy Hour so much as other friend of us and the podcast, Noel Murray, who is not hearing this because he doesn't listen to podcasts, is an animated Brazilian film called Boy in the World. And this film was completely not on my radar, even though it was released by G-Kids, which is the best animation company out there, getting the rights to really interesting stuff from around the world and releasing it. This film is the story of a young Brazilian boy looking for his father, who seems to be a migrant worker who's gone off to work and not come back, sort of. It's almost hard to explain because the film is so steeped in the subjective experience of childhood, and it's so steeped in the subjective experience of what is around him. And it starts with this like little crayon drawing of a boy interacting with the world, and that world gets bigger and bigger as he interacts with more of it. But it's still this very simplistic child's drawing crayon style that is just expanded into this very dense and beautiful world. And the two of you in the room who are parents, I think really should see this film, because it's so beautiful, but it's also just so connected with what it feels like to be a child in the world.
Would our kids like it?
I don't know, but I think it's child safe. It may be a little like narratively abstract for them. The storytelling is very abstract, but the imagery is so surreal and fascinating and beautiful.
Are there puppies who rescue people? Because if there were, that would definitely be a hit at my house.
There is a scene where somebody rescues a puppy, and I actually thought, do I need to go register this film at doesthedogdie.com? Because, I mean, it is I wouldn't say a traumatic scene. It's very brief, but it is kind of an emotional scene.
Goodness. Well, from my experience, actually, kids do deal better with abstraction than adults, so I think they would handle it just fine. I mean, for the longest time, my oldest daughter, her favorite film was My Neighbor Totoro, and that's not, you know, she was like 3 or 4 and connected really strongly to that over, you know, films that were told in a much more straightforward fashion. It's really adults who are closed-minded.
Well, they better not be closed-minded against My Neighbor Totoro, because that is one of the best films of all time, animated, children or otherwise. But Scott, you might have some film that you would think is close to the best film of all time, or at least worth recommending. What do you have to recommend?
Well, I don't know about it's. I'll take you on a journey. And that journey is me not really getting off to the strongest start this year. I was very slow, and part of my procrastination was rewatching all the films with Quentin Tarantino, because I'd watched The Hateful Hate a couple of times, and I can rank them for you. Do you want to hear a ranking? I'll do it real fast.
A ranking of the 8 in The Hateful Eight.
I'll say 9. Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Kill Bill Volume 1, Inglourious Basterds, Kill Bill Volume 2, Reservoir Dogs, Hateful Eight, Django Unchained, Death Proof. Okay, so that's the ranking, but.
How dare you throw that on the table and then walk away from it?
I'm going to walk away from it because I have to move on. This is like a whole thing. This could be a whole show. I want to recommend The Experience because I think in that very next picture show way that the context of his career means something, especially in Tarantino's case, because he's been very deliberate about plotting his career. I mean, if you remember that interview he did with Charlie Rose, and he said this many times, like he wants to do, 10 films? There's a very deliberate plotting that going on that involves all of his work and all of it working in union together it's a very closed system. It's like Steve Jobs or something. That's a weird comparison, Steve Jobs and Quentin Tarantino. But in any case, you know, the first three films, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, are striking in part because their stylized language and genre trappings are situated in a real contemporary, you know, recognizable world, which is part of what makes them effective. Then his last three films, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, Hateful Eight, they're all historical pieces. But I think in the case of the last two, they're more intent on speaking to the culture and politics of the modern world than the early ones that actually took place in the world in which we live. And I think it's kind of helpful and fun to step back and consider these works together and how they relate rather than just by their individual merits. Because I think when these things come out, it's almost as if they get considered in a vacuum, and seeing them together and how in the rhymes and themes and just, you know, the very just the way he micromanages his own career and his own filmography is interesting. It's a big machine, you know, and I think that the sum is more substantial than the parts.
I think we're all still back there on your list and disagreeing with you about various tiny elements of it. I also find it hard to think of Tarantino as somebody whose films get considered in a vacuum, because his personality and the way he expresses himself, the way he communicates about his films, the degree to which he communicates about his films is such a part of the narrative. I don't think his films get considered in isolation.
Maybe that's me being ungenerous.
It's like you being ungenerous, not to him, but to the critical community.
But it's a system. But it's true. That's wrong. But there is a system at work there with these films. I guess they are kind of they are trilogies. Some of them and some of them fall in between. But I do think that, and I think that, I mean, this is true really of binge watching any one filmmaker's work. It's kind of instructive to see to trace the connections and to sort of, you know, understand the arc of their career and why where their heads were at certain moments in their career. So I think as an experience, you know, it's worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not just with Tarantino, but the idea of binge watching anybody to see what comes out of it, I think, is a really good experience.
Totally. Next is Fassbender. It's going to take a long time. Rachel, Keith, Tasha, great choices. I think, you know, I think really you could limit yourself to just seeing, you know, the one thing or the one or two things that you all have recommended instead of the nine films that I have recommended. but if you have a lot of time, maybe you'll want to do all those things. And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Before closing the book on this week's episode, let's reveal the movie pairing for our next episode, which comes out February 2nd and 4th. Keith, what you got for us?
Since we're in the doldrums of the winter season, we're looking back on one of the biggest hits of last year, Ridley Scott's The Martian, and one of the biggest flops of the decade, Andrew Stanton's 2012 science fiction fantasy, John Carter. They're two very different stories of what it takes for a crafty American to survive in the harsh climate of the Red Planet, and should make for some interesting comparisons.
Definitely. That's a great pairing. I'm excited about that, just because I haven't seen, you know, John Carter. Can I say that I slept through a little bit of it? I wasn't that.
You didn't review it.
Did you sleep through the part of John Carter where he grows potatoes in his own poop?
Oh, see. That part I saw. So in the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, 45 Years, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. In the meantime, where can we find everyone these days? Rachel Handler.
I'm on Twitter @Rachel_Handler, and I'm writing for Vanity Fair and Uproxx and Cosmo and Vulture, and I think that's it.
Keith, what about you?
I'm on Twitter @KPhipps3000, and I am running the film and TV sections of Uproxx.
What about you, Tasha Robinson?
I am the film critic for The Verge at TheVerge.com, and you can find me on Twitter @myname with no space, Tasha Robinson.
Okay, and you can follow me on Twitter and Peach.
I can't believe you're still pushing the peach thing.
You can like to trace things with your hands. Anyway, you can follow me on Twitter and Peach @Scott_Tobias. Why is everybody laughing at Peach? In any case, you can find my writing at NPR, Variety, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Oscilloscope's Musings, and Uproxx. I have a piece that ran on Uproxx, so I'm excited about that. So that's where you can find me. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter @NextPicturePod or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes, and while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks again to Genevieve Kosky for producing the show. You can find her on Twitter @GenevieveKosky, and to our parent podcast, Film Spotting, for all their help, input, and support. Please tune in next time, where we're going to follow in Matt Damon's poop steps and science the crap out of this thing. Tears I cannot hide.